Chodesh Tov. So I have to thank Zamira for the opportunity for me to get to explore Zeresh. Not necessarily one of my favorite characters up till now, but what I hope we'll be able to do today is, first of all, see a little bit more about the character of Zeresh, the other members of Haman's family. We'll see how Chazal expand and develop their characters. We'll also try to understand what role these very minor characters play in the story, and we'll see that they're not so minor. And we'll try to understand who's against whom and where they fit in the story. So if you have the sources, we're not going to read all of the sources on these three pages. We'll look at some of them. We'll start with the Psukim. We meet Zeresh in two instances in the Megillah. And to put things into perspective, right, Haman has already had his frustrating, aggravating encounter with Mordechai, who refuses to bow down. Haman already in his own mind decides that the right thing to do is to kill Mordechai. Okay? And then we meet Haman coming home, right, having been to the first banquet, okay, and knowing that he's invited for the next night as well. And that's the scene in which we're going to open and where we'll first meet Zeresh. That's the scene in Perek Hey. Vayetze Haman bayom hahu, sameach v'tov lev. Haman leaves the banquet very pleased, right? It was a successful evening out. Plus, he has an invitation for tomorrow night. V'chirot Haman et Mordechai b'shar ha-melech v'lo kam v'lo zami menu. This is the repeat performance of Haman encountering Mordechai. Right? He's seen him before, earlier in Perek Gimel, when Mordechai first refuses to bow down. Haman says, I should kill this guy. Right? And now on his way home, feeling very good and full of himself and feeling proud that he was invited exclusively with the king and the queen, right? He bumps into his nemesis. The guy who always is there and always reminds Haman that there's somebody or some ones, right, who don't really give Haman the honor that he thinks he deserves. But then Pasuk Yud tells us something interesting. Vayit apak Haman. He kind of restrains himself. He doesn't explode. He doesn't do anything dramatic on the scene with Mordechai. He doesn't arrest Mordechai. Somehow he manages to, hold it in, and he makes it home. Vayavo el beto, right? He comes home. Vayishlach vayave et ohavav ve'et Zeresh ishto. If I had to paint the picture here, right, I would paint, he seems to have walked in and nobody's at home, right? He comes in, the house is dark and empty, right? And he quickly summons, right? He wants to talk to somebody. Maybe he wants to tell them about the party. Maybe he wants to talk about Mordechai, right? The frustration that he just feels having just passed Mordechai. But he walks in and there's nobody there, right? So what does he do? He sends for and he brings his beloved, right, his cronies, and Zeresh, his wife. And we'll have to follow the order of these two, Ohavav and Zeresh Ishto, because we'll see that in the two scenes we're going to encounter them in different orders. Vayisaper lahem Haman et kvod ashro v'rov banav v'et kol asher giblo ha-melech v'et asher niso al hasarim v'avdei ha-melech. He tells them things that we would, quite frankly, think they already know, right? They know about his wealth, about his rov banav, his many sons. Now, the text doesn't tell us how many is many, and we'll see that Chazal have discussion over how many are many. And he tells about this great position of power that the king has promoted him to, higher than everybody else. Again, we have to only wonder why in Perek Hey, right, this is news, right? Haman's talking to his wife and his ohavim, right? Don't they know all of this? And then Haman continues, Vayomer Haman in Pasuk Yud Bet, Af lo hevia Esther ha-malkayim ha-melech el ha-mishter asher asata, ki imoti. Reminding you, if you want to know how important I am, I'm the only one that the queen invited to her feast. V'gam l'machar ani karu la'im ha-melech. I'm invited again tomorrow, but, the big but, Pasuk Yud Gimel, v'chol zeh einenu shoveli. It's not worth anything, the fact that I'm so important. And I have all these good invitations because בכל עת אשר אני רואה את מרדכי היהודי יושב בשער המלך, because I keep bumping into Mordechai, right? And he refuses to bow down to me. And he doesn't even have to fill in that part about, and he refuses to bow down to me, which makes us feel like they've had this conversation before, right? Everybody knows what he means when he says, I see Mordechai at the gates, right? He doesn't even have to finish his sentence. And immediately, Pasuk Yudalid, Vatomer lo zeresh ishto v'chol o'avav. Here the order is reversed. And the verb of speaking is credited only to zeresh, right? It doesn't say vayomrulo in the plural, right? Zeresh and all of his cronies pipe up, but she's the speaker. And she says, Ya'asu etz gavoa chamishim ama. I've got the solution, right? Let's make a tall gallows, 50 cubits high. Uvaboker emor lamelech v'itlu et Mordechai alav. And in the morning, right, tell the king, don't do this without permission in the middle of the night, right? Tell the king in the morning, and, right, then you'll hang Mordechai. Uvoim amelech ala mishte sameach, and then tomorrow you'll be able to go to the party feeling really good and happy. V'yitava davar lifnei Haman v'yas ha'etz. And Haman thinks this is a great idea, and he makes the gallows. First of all, we have to wonder, right, did it take Zeresh to come up with this great idea? Right? Haman himself already said in Perek Gimel that he should kill Mordechai, right? What's Zeresh's great idea here? And, right, this, we wonder, who's part of the household? Who are these Ohavim? He tells them about Rov Banav, but we don't hear about his many sons or many children in the narrative as coming. Okay, but that's where we first meet Zeresh. So she's the one who comes up with the great idea, right, of gallows. Hang Mordechai and, right, but then she adds that important point, do it with royal permission in the morning. Don't sneak it in the middle of the night, right? Don't assassinate him. Make sure it's done in daylight with the king's permission. Fast forward, right, after Haman is excited by the plan, right? Then, right, we get to Perek Vav. Perek Vav is the critical story of Balaila Hahuna Didashnat HaMelech. And this is information that we, the reader, know, right? Zeresh doesn't know this story, and Haman doesn't know this story. We, the reader, know that Achashverosh couldn't sleep well that night. And, right, what story do they read to him in the Chronicles? You had about Bigtan and Teresh. Right, and what's the story about Bigtan and Teresh really about? What? An assassination plot, right? And possible treason. And what punishment do they meet? They're hung. Okay, remember that. Okay? They're hung, and then, right, that's what leads Achashverosh to ask, right, how did I get the tip? And was the person who tipped me off credited, right? And that's where he decides that Mordechai is worthy of being honored because he's never been repaid for tipping the king off about these two traitors, right, who were plotting to assassinate the king, and they met their fate by being hung. That's the punishment for traitors. Remember that. We'll come back to that. So, right, and then we know the twist in the story, right? Haman shows up in the middle of all of this discussion between Achashverosh and his courtiers, and right, gets the dishonorable job now of needing to honor Mordechai, right, by leading him through the street in all the royal regalia and declaring and pronouncing that this is the one that the king likes to honor. And if we come now to our pasukim, pasuk yud aleph, v'yikach Haman et halavush v'et hasus v'yalbesh et Mordechai v'yarkiveu b'rchov v'ir v'yikra lefanav. It's public, right? It's loud. He pronounces it, right? Nobody could pretend that they don't know what's going on. And then Mordechai goes back off the horse, right? Back to his usual post at the gates. And we know what he does at the gates, right? He defies Haman and refuses to bow down. These are very strange descriptions of Haman. First of all, we have this unusual verb, nidchaf, which we'll have to define. Haman goes back to his house in the mode of something that the text describes to us as nidchaf. And he's described as avail, mourning, vachafui rosh, some kind of head covering. Not obvious what that is. And he gets home, and this time he doesn't have to summon the people in the house. Remember last night they weren't home when he got there? Now they're all there. Vayisaper Haman lezeresh ishto lecholo avav, and here we have the order of his cronies and his wife reversed from last night's story. He tells to Zeresh and to all of his ohavim, et kol asher karahu, this whole story that just befell him. Vayomru lo chachamav v'zeresh ishto, and now the chachamim, the wise men there, plus Zeresh say to him, in the plural, this time the verb is attributed to all of them. Now they say to him, im mizera ha-yehudim Mordechai asher achilot alin po lefanav, lo tuchalo, ki nafol tipol lefanav. Now they put all the pieces together. They say, if this Mordechai, right, is really a Jew, right, then you're doomed. You're not going to be able to withstand him. And, right, the story ends that, as they're talking, Esther's servants come to whisk Haman off to banquet number two. Those are the two stories, two scenes in which we meet Zeresh. So what do we know about her? She's Haman's wife. We know that she's not the only one he loves, right? He has these ohavim that he loves and that seem to be there equally to her, right? When he snaps his fingers, they show up along with Zeresh. We hear that there are rov banav in the family, but we haven't yet heard about them. And what role does Zeresh play? She gets one speaking line, right? In the second scene in Perek Vav, it's the Chachamim plus Zeresh who speak. But Zeresh gets one speaking line. What's her line in Perek Hay? Make a tree. Use a tree and make gallows to hang Haman. And, right, we have to wonder, why did it take Zeresh, right, to come up with this idea? Haman himself had already said he wants to kill Mordechai. We seem to know that hanging is a popular punishment. Bigtan and Teresh were killed by hanging, right? Takes Zeresh to come up with this idea, and Haman thinks it's a great idea. And on the side, right, we don't meet Zeresh or any of the family members by name, but we have to wonder what this strange entry of Haman in Perek Vav back to his house is. It's described as, right, in Pasuk Yud Bet, v'Haman nidchaf el beto, this unusual verb, in the nif'al form, right? The nif'al form is a verb that you do to yourself, right? So what's he doing to himself? Right? It doesn't say v'Haman dachaf el beto, which is a biblical verb for hurrying. It says nidchaf, and one has to wonder what that verb means. And those two descriptions, that he comes home, avel v'chafui rosh, some kind of mourning mode. Okay? And this time he comes in and he finds everybody waiting for him. So those are the two scenes in which we meet Zeresh. What's interesting to see is how Chazal fill in the story. First of all, these two scenes. Second of all, the characters involved. Zeresh, the Oavim, the Chachamim. Who are these Rov Banav? How many are there? And Chazal, of course, will also help us find the daughter, right? The missing daughter is never mentioned by name. So we'll look at some of the next sources to try to see how Chazal built the characters and tell the story. Chazal also try to fill in who is Zeresh? What's her background? We know that Haman is Ha'agagi. But who is Zeresh? What family is she from? Maybe that can help us understand a little bit more about why she's the one with that great idea of the hanging. And we'll also then have to come back to the question of the hanging. What does that represent? Who gets hung in the story? And then we'll conclude by trying to tie some of the pieces together and see what roles Zeresh and the relatives play in the story. So if we look at source number one, the Midrash from Esther Rabbah, we're not going to read the whole thing. We'll read the opening line, right? And this is speaking about which story? Perek Hay or Perek Vav? It quotes the verse where Ohavav are first. So that's Perek Hay, right? But the one in which Zeresh actually spoke. And the Midrash says, ובכולם לא היו יודעים לתת עצה כזרש אשתו. He had all of these אוהבים and חכמים and wise people around him, but guess what? None was as good an advisor, an עצה giver, as זרש. שהיו לו 365 בעלי עצה. Haman, in case we were wondering, didn't do everything by himself. He had 365 advisors, כמניין ימות החמה, you know, one for every day of the calendar year. He was never left without someone to give him great advice. But, right, who's above all these 365 advisors? Zeresh. So she is the arch advisor. And now the Midrash tries to tell us what was so profound and brilliant about Zeresh's idea of Ya'asu Etz. Hang him on a gallows. Build a gallows. אמרה לו אשתו, אדם זה שאתה שואל עליו אם מזרע היהודים הוא, לא תוכל לו. This guy, right, that we're all wondering, is he Jewish? I'm telling you, you're not going to be able to succeed to kill him. How? אם לא תבוא עליו בחוכמה. You're going to need to come up, she says, with a really good, wise plan how to kill Mordechai. Why? Because it's not so easy, she says, to kill a Jew. If he's from the Jews, you'll see if I trace Jewish history that it's not so easy to kill someone who's one of the Jews. Why? Because you're going to have to try, she says, b'ma shelo nisa echad mibnei umato. You're going to have to find a death for Mordechai that hasn't yet been tried on one of his co-religionists. And she gives him some background information. She says, if you try to throw him into a fiery furnace, well, that won't work. It failed with Avraham. If you try to throw him into a lion's den, that won't work. It failed with Daniel. If you throw him into jail, Yosef got out of jail. And the Midrash then goes on and gives several other examples in Jewish history. And then in the second to last line I brought you here, right, she gives the example of Shimshon. You can try poking out his eyes. But look, Shimshon managed to kill quite a lot of Plishtim, even with his eyes gouged. And then she comes up with her brilliant idea. She says, there's one mode of death that hasn't yet been tried against a Jew. And that is, right, the Midrash uses the Aramaic word, tsluv. But we should know that word, right? It's like the word that we use in modern Hebrew of a cross, a tslav. Right? You can crucify him, which is what hanging is. You can hang him on the cross, which is exactly the verb for hanging. Right? And so obviously there's a certain echo here and an anti-Christian polemic that's also hovering here in the background. Right? Chazal are suggesting or attributing to Zeresh, understanding that this form of death hasn't yet been tried yet. This is one that Jews may still fall for, right? But throwing him into a fiery furnace or a lion's den or poking out his eyes, all of that, she says, is useless. You want to do away with someone who's from that line, the Jews? Try something that they haven't tried yet. Hang him on a tree. The Aramaic word is litzlovoto, right? Because you have to make a cross in order to be able to put the person on, right? And so that is the word, though, that's used in later rabbinic sources for the crucifixion. And Haman thinks that's a great idea. So the first thing now that this Midrash fills in for us is it's not that Zeresh is offering the idea that nobody else thought of. Right? Haman thought on his own that he should kill Mordechai. What Zeresh is credited for, according to the Midrash, is figuring out which mode of death, right, would actually work to kill Mordechai. She says to Haman, it's not so simple to kill a Jew. You'll see, right? And then she tells him, right, she delineates who's been killed in which, or who's been punished in which way, and it didn't end up killing them. So she says, there's one form of death, right, that hasn't yet happened and worked for a Jew. Try that. Professor Yoni Grossman Rav from the Gush, right, has a very interesting analysis of the hanging in the Megillah. And he points to the fact that who really gets hung? We know Bigtan and Teresh got hung for treason. And perhaps that's really, he suggests, what's behind Zeresh's suggestion of Ya'asu Etz. She's suggesting, let's get Mordechai, right, not simply killed because you can't stand him, but let's get Mordechai charged for treason, right? Labeled as a threat to the entire government, right? You being the highest ranking official. And then we'll be able to have him punished in the, call it, normative punishment of hanging. And Yoni Grossman notes that that's why she highlights, and in the morning, go tell the king, and then they'll hang Mordechai. In other words, right, this has to be through the official procedures and channels, because hanging, right, is a punishment reserved for, right, for treason. So she wants to get Mordechai charged with treason. But now the story becomes so much more connected, right? What's the story that interrupts her idea in Perek Hey of make gallows for Mordechai? And the king, right, can't sleep. And then what story do they happen, right? There's no happening in the Megillah. Everything is providentially, right, pulled like the strings of a marionette. Right? What's the story that they happen upon, right? The story of Mordechai's loyalty and Bigtan and Teresh's treason and Bigtan and Teresh getting hung, right? And then, of course, right, what do we, the reader, know that Zeresh and Haman don't know? Mordechai's the last guy now that you could accuse of treason, right? And if you're planning in the morning to come to Ahasuerus and tell him, right, that Mordechai should be hung as a traitor, right? It's not going to happen, right? So we, the reader, now put all of the pieces together. And of course, if we fast forward in the Megillah, what is the fate that meets Haman and his family? They are the traitors, right? They're the ones who get hung on the very same gallows at the end, right? So we have our hanging motif, and it's not just simply the technical reversal of the hanging motif, who was supposed to live, right, gets hung, and who was supposed to be hung survives and rises to greatness. But it's this whole twist of, really, the undercurrent is, who's really loyal and who's really the traitor, right? So that ties it all together. So Zeresh, in her advice, right, is in essence charging Mordechai with treason, right? But we, the reader, who've been seeing the providential side of the story, right, we know that middle incident in between these two scenes, right? And we know that Mordechai is not viewed as a traitor. He's viewed as the loyalist. And it's Haman who becomes, right, the traitor with his plan to kill out Mordechai and Esther's nation. So that's our tying together of the strings of the plot and the role of the tree and the hanging and the gallows. So who else is in Haman's family, right? We meet Zeresh and we meet these Ohavim, who might have been those 365 other advisors. They're also called the Chachamim, who are around Haman, which makes sense that those are his advisors. Haman refers to Rov Banav, to lots of kids, right? At the end of the Megillah, we meet 10 sons being hung. Is 10 so many, right? Would you describe 10 as Rov Banav, right? His many-fold children? So it's interesting. Chazal, in different Midrashim and Agadot in the Gemara, expand Haman's family from what the text tells us, right? From the text alone, we'd only know of these 10 sons. Chazal fill it in, and they really make it Rov Banav Vibito, right? And his daughter. Source number 2 is the very famous Gemara, in which, in Aramaic, that's why I brought you the English, we meet Haman's daughter. And we meet Haman's daughter as the bridge in the scene in Perek Vav. And I'm saying the bridge because we have Haman passing Mordechai at the gate, right? And then we have Haman with that strange verb, nidchaf el beito. And then he comes home, avel v'chafui rosh, mourning and covered, right? His head is covered. And Chazal fill in, why is he mourning and why is his head covered? What happened in between, right? So we can read the version in the English. As he was leading him through the street where Haman lived, right, as Haman was leading Mordechai through the streets, his daughter who was standing on the roof saw him. She thought that the man on the horse was her father and the man walking before him was Mordechai, as should be, right? So she took, the English here translates, this is the Sansino translation, they translated it as chamber pot. The Aramaic in the Gemara is atzitza, maybe even more of a planter. But in one of the other Midrashim, it's a different word, which basically means a bucket. Okay, so it might have had dirty sponge water in it. but she takes something with dirty water, with dirty liquid, either a chamber pot where somebody's used for their personal needs, or some kind of a bucket with dirty water, or right, what's at the bottom of a planter, also the drippings and the dirt. So there's dirty water, right? She takes that and empties it on the head of her father. He looks up, right? And when she saw that he's the one leading the horse, right, and not on the horse, she commits suicide and jumps off the roof, kills herself. And that is why Haman, right, goes back to his home, avail, says the Gemara, mourning for his daughter, v'chafui rosh, covered with whatever schmutz she poured on him. Aha. So if Zeresh is Haman's most loyal advisor, loyaler than all the 365 advisors of the 365 days of the year, right? What role does the daughter play in the story, according to Chazal, right? She's not in the text. But according to Chazal, right, what role do they give her? Yeah, I mean, she brings the first step of Haman's downfall to begin to happen. First of all, she also adds scorn and shame to this already awful experience of parading Mordechai through the streets of the city. Right? And, right, now he has also the personal tragedy. His daughter just committed suicide in front of him. And all of the emotional baggage. And so now we can only guess what that verb nidchaf el beito means. He rushes off home, right? Because now also he has to tell his wife and everybody who's waiting at home, right, to continue egging him on with the plot of the gallows, right? And go now and tell Achashverosh and make sure that Mordechai is officially charged with treason. Now Haman has to walk into all of this and announce that, right? His daughter just committed suicide, jumped off the roof, right? Because, right, she added insult to injury and poured junk on his head. That's the role Chazal create for his daughter. What about the sons, right? Haman speaks about Rov Banav. We know of 10 later. That's source number 3. A machloket in Masechet Megillah. Right? Masechet Megillah in the first parak has a very extensive set of drashot that go through many of the psukim of the Megillah. And here we have a three-way machloket of how many sons Haman has. V'yisaper lahem Haman et kvodo shrov v'rov banav. V'chama rov banav. Can you quantify rov banav, please? Right? How many are there? Amar Rav, 30. He has 30 sons. Asara metu, v'asara nitlu, v'asara mechazrin al haptachin. These 30 had different fates. 10 of them were murdered in the battles in Shushan. 10 of them were hung, as we know from the Megillah. And the other 10 became paupers and went around becoming beggars. The expression in Chazal of lachazor al haptachim, right, is the ani, is the poor person who's the pauper who has to go begging. So, right, he tells them now about oshro v'rov banav, about his wealth and about his numerous family, right? He's boasting, right? And fast forward, right, says Rav, the fate of some of his sons, some will be killed, and others will lose the wealth and have to go begging. That's one opinion. V'rabanan amre, otan shemechazrin al haptachin, shivim havaya. He agrees that there are three groups of sons, 10 who get killed in battle, 10 who get hung, but he says there are 70 paupers who have to go around begging. So Haman has 90 sons, according to the opinion of Rabbanan. Virami bar Abba Amar, Chulan Matayim Vishmone Havu. He has 208 sons. How do we get to 208? If you like gematria, Shineemar v'rov banav. Haman said, I have rov banav. I have rov, that many sons. And the word virov in gematria is 208. Okay, so what are Chazal trying to tell us here, first of all? Right, that he's a busy man, right? Yafeh. And the truth is that does connect to a drasha that I didn't include in the source sheet, that Chazal read that phrase of Zeresh Ishto V'chol Ohavav, and they read it actually as pejorative for Zeresh. It's really Ohaveha. It's all of her lovers. That's how there's a midrash that actually suggests, right, that she's got all of these lovers and this whole other side of her life, right, and that not all of the children are actually Haman's. But, right, leaving that aside, Haman is credited here with having Rov Banav, right, which Chazal say is more than the text tells us, but the message of Chazal is not a one, right, follows in his father's footsteps, becomes prominent at the king's court, right, and not a one ends the story of the Megillah with his head raised up. So the daughter jumps from the roof, right, the sons, everybody meets their own fate, some are murdered, some are hung, and some become paupers. So that's Haman's happy family, right? So where's Zeresh from, right? The text doesn't tell us where she's from. The Targum, the Aramaic rendering of Megillat Esther, fills in the pieces and it tells us, translated into Hebrew, that Zeresh, when we first meet her in Perakeh, the Targum actually tells us who Zeresh is. It says that she's the daughter of somebody that we know. We know him if we know Sefer Ezra. She's the daughter of someone who's mentioned in the book of Ezra, whose name is Tatnai, and he has a very important job. He's the Fecha. He's the, we use that verb in the Turkish administration, in the Ottoman Empire also. He is the administrative local leader of the province of Judea at the time of Shivat Zion, at the time that, right, a small minority of Jews chose to come back from Persia, with Cyrus's edict, Koresh's declaration, and the purpose of their return was to begin building Beit HaMikdash, the walls of Jerusalem, restarting the economy, which had collapsed over the 70-plus years of exile, and hopefully begin to rebuild a second Jewish commonwealth, right? A monarchy, perhaps, certainly a temple, and hopefully lead more people to come back. Now, why is this important information that the Targum tells us, that she's the daughter of this Tatnai? Because this helps put together a lot of pieces of the Purim story. It's important to remember that what we read as Megillat Esther, it's a diaspora tale. It begins in the diaspora, and it ends in the diaspora, and it has a happy ending. But it's a story that takes place, and if we would read it in a vacuum, we would think that all the Jews at that time, right, lived in the Gola, right, in the diaspora. It's a story, they're in Shushan at the beginning, they have a crisis, they're saved, and they live happily ever after, it seems, in Shushan at the end of the book. The problem is that the story takes place at a time when you didn't have to live in Shushan, because the story of the Megillah takes place during that in-between period, as the edict of Cyrus was issued, and the first group of returnees heeded the call, and they were a small group, and they were a very mixed bag of people who had various interests. Some of the old-timers go back, they have good memories, right? They left when they were 4 or 5, and they go back, hoping to, right, lachzir atara liyoshna, to restore the glory of what used to be. Who else went back? Kohanim and Leviim. They have a job in this for them. But then who else would have gone back and left the comfortable life of, right, Shushan, Habirah, and the Persian Empire? Maybe some people who didn't quite make it, maybe some of the misfits of society, maybe some entrepreneurs, right, people with an adventurous spirit who said, what the heck? Maybe some arch-messianists, right, or call it arch-believers, right, who remember those prophecies of Yirmiyahu, who said 70 years you'll come back, and they said, by hook or by crook, right, as difficult as it'll be, I'll go back. And the small group of returnees, right, received royal backing from Cyrus. But when they get here to this land, right, there are foes. There are people that have been living here for 70 plus years. They're not so interested in this group of returnees. They're certainly not pleased by the starting to lay a foundation for a temple, fix the walls of Jerusalem, rebuild parts, fix the economy. They're not very happy about this. And periodically, right, these are the events recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, periodically the locals basically issue work stop orders, right, and block, and even worse than that, they physically and militarily interfere with the efforts to build. The local leader at this time, right, who's appointed, he's a puppet of the administration back in Persia, his name is Tatnai. He is the official local leader here. And in Ezra Perakeh, we have the incident in which Tatnai, right, comes and accuses the Jews who are building and asks them, who gave you permission? Right, and he's involved in one of several stops of the work. Okay, and now Chazal tell us that Zeresh is his daughter. So first of all, like father, like daughter, right? He had an axe to grind with the Jewish people. He stops the work of the returnees who are back in Jerusalem starting to build the temple, right? He has an axe to grind with the Jewish people. And, right, she seems to have inherited that, especially in her second piece of advice in which she says to Mordechai, to Haman, if Mordechai's from those Jews, right, you're not going to be able to stop him so easily. Maybe her father hasn't been successful, right? She seems to have a little bit of perspective. But it's even more than just simply connecting her to her father's actions that Chazal might be telling us here. What Chazal are trying to remind us is the complexity of the time of the Purim story. The Purim story, and we're going to be very happy when the Jews of Shushan are saved at the end, the Purim story, though, is taking place with those people that didn't heed the call, pack their bags and make aliyah and take the biggest risks and come when the going was really tough here. And, shall we say, even when they were under threat and their lives were at stake before they were saved in the story, they also didn't pack their bags and go on aliyah. Good. Good. So Chazal give Mordechai a role in that, but all the other Jews in Shushan. Right. Correct. So you're suggesting that if Eretz Yisrael was one of the 127 provinces, it might not have been much safer. Chazal, excellent. Chazal, in trying to figure out which king Achashverosh is in the line, right, connect him also with some of the edicts of stopping the work here in Eretz Yisrael, and they say it's all happening at the same time. Right, but by connecting Zeresh to the time in which the story is taking place, right, Chazal, first of all, are cluing us in, right, that she comes from, you know, a good line of anti-Semites and of those who were interested in stopping the new, right, possibility of the new Commonwealth to begin, right? And, right, it helps us fill in the fact that, right, let's just remember this. This is a story taking place in a community that chose not to go back. Hashem still intervenes in Jewish history and saves them. We, the reader, kind of wonder what happens at the end. Yes, say Chazal, though. Keep reading Ezra and Nehemiah, right? Then there are larger waves of return led by Ezra and Nehemiah and purging, right, Gentile wives and teaching the people the mitzvot again, so that the story of Purim is only part of a much bigger tale of the beginning of the Second Temple period. So that's something that we can learn just from this little fact, right, that the Targum and some other Midrashic sources fill in by trying to tell us who Zeresh is. A few additional comments about Zeresh and Haman's family. In number 5, I brought you a fascinating comment of Rabbeinu Bechaya on Parshat Korach, and he actually compares Zeresh and her advice and what it caused her husband with Korach's wife. Okay? And he actually says that Korach and Haman can be compared because they were both extremely wealthy and extremely prominent, and each one had some kind of a plan to undermine the mainstream. And in each case, right, there are midrashim about Korach's wife that credit her with giving him the idea of some of his initial challenges to Moshe. But Chazal say Zeresh, right? She even was greater than Korach's wife. But Zeresh and Korach's wife here get a nice comparison. So that's another way to tell us what they think of him. Sources number 6 and 7 deal with the question of the order of Zeresh Ishto and Kolo Hadvav that's reversed in the two passages that we read. And also the question of, right, I said if I had to draw the scene in Perakeh, I'd imagine that Haman came home and the house is empty, right? And then Vayishlach Vayaveh, right? He sends forth, he sends a message, and then they show up, right? Zeresh and all his Ohavim. But where were they? So I brought you just to see two very, very different suggestions of where Zeresh was. Why wasn't she waiting at the front door for her husband in Parakeh when he walked in? So source number 6, which is the Maharal's Perush to Megillat Esther, there he suggests that the Ohavim were out of the house. They didn't live in the house. Therefore, Mordechai had to send for them. Zeresh was in the house, but just in a different room. Yafeh. Source number 7, though, the Perush of Da'at Mikra, has a different perspective and actually says something quite disturbing. If we read the first two lines, Ve'et Zeresh Ishto, why did she need to be called for, says that the Perush of Da'at Mikra. Mistaber Shahaman Nahag Kiderech HaMelachim. Haman was like, acted like royalty. Ishto lo hayta imo beveito. He didn't live in the same house as his wife. Ella kilua bebeit hanashim asher lo. She was locked up in the harem, just like the king locked his wives up. And now Haman goes and sends for her. So just these two different sources, right, have to paint us two very different pictures of why Haman has to, you know, call for Zeresh, right? Either she's in the next room, right? She's doing laundry, right? She's taking a nap, right? Or, right, according to Da'at Mikra, oh no, she doesn't live at home with him, right? He locks her up in the harem, just like Achashverosh locked up all of his wives in Beit Hanashim. So that's just an interesting insight. And then Da'at Mikra makes the interesting insight in Perek Vav on Pasuk Yud Gimel about why the order is reversed. There, right, he tells it first to Zeresh and to all of his Ohavim. This time they're there ready and waiting. And he says, of course, he spoke to her first because he's now continuing with her great suggestion from last night. Right, so she's the object to which he would want to speak. In this nice perush, which I took off the pretty cover, right? It's the Yediot Achronot set of some of the Megillot edited by Avigdor Shinan, Professor Shinan. So here they make the suggestion that the verb nidchaf, remember that verb when Haman came back to his house? We talked about the avel, we talked about the chafui rosh. So they talk about the reflective verb. It's in the nif'al form, right? He doesn't do it to himself, it's done to him. And even though it's really a biblical verb, dachaf is a verb, we use it in modern Hebrew as to push, but it means to, like, hurry, to rush. And so they suggest that this is a verb that, yes, Haman did it to himself. He was so humiliated by this scene of leading Mordechai on the streets, right, that he just literally raced himself home, right? He did it to himself, right? He rushed himself home, but also, they add, that he also was in a rush because he wanted to make good on Zeresh's advice from last night. He was still pleased with the advice. Achashverosh just kind of took him off course now by sending him out leading Mordechai on the horse, right? So now he's like hurrying back in, all enthusiastic because he's motivated internally, right, to go ahead and get back on plan with Mordechai. And to close, right, I brought the passage that we sing at the anonymous song of Asher Heini, which we know mostly for the final verses, right, which we sing after reading the Megillah. It's a poem that we don't know the author. It's from sometime in the Middle Ages in Ashkenaz. It starts with an Aleph. The first verse is Asher Heini, and it's an Aleph Bet poem. Most of us, right, know the verses that start with the Shin and the Tav, right, the final lines of the poem, right, and that is Shoshanat Yaakov, right, and in this song, we celebrate the victory of the Jewish people, who are described here as the Shoshanat Yaakov, the Rose of Yaakov, right? Rejoices at the end of the story when they saw Tchelet Mordechai parading out in the royal garments at the end of the Megillah, right? And then the tough line, Shuatam Hayita Lanetzach V'tikvatam B'chol Dor V'dor, we say to Hashem, speaking to Hashem, we say, you have always been their salvation and their hope throughout generations. In other words, all of the characters in the Megillah are just your pawns, right? You pulled all of the strings like marionettes on the stage. They didn't do anything. It was you, Hashem, who always have been the salvation and the hope of the Jewish people. And then after the acrostic of the alphabet ends, right, the official poem seems to end with the next line. Lehodia, all of this teaches, right, you the listener should learn the lesson. Shekol kovecha lo yevoshu v'lo yikalmu lanetzach kol achosim bach, weaving various psukim from Tehillim and Nevi'im here. To teach us all that those who have hope in Hashem, right, will never be disappointed, will always be saved. And then we add four lines of curses. And here we do a little bit of what the Gemara commands, that on Purim, right, you need to either drink or get yourself into a state where you can't distinguish between who's on the cursed list and who's on the blessed list. But here, after the Megillah, we're still all very sober. Plus, we've just had our 10 and a half chapters to help us focus and realize how the story unfolded, right? And we've just declared that it's Hashem who's been there pulling the strings throughout, right? So we can put characters in, Zeresh, the daughter, the sons, the Yoatzim, right? But really, right, the whole story comes neatly woven together by Hashem's upper arm. And then we end with the curses, right? We curse Haman, who wanted to destroy Mordechai, Arur Haman asher bikesh lobdi, right? And then we make sure we remember who's on the Baruch list. And then we add, Arura Zeresh Eshet Mefchidi. She's also on the cursed list, and we can only understand why. Either because she's the one who told him Yasu Eitz, because no Jew's ever been, you know, hung on a tree. So that one might work, right? Or, like Professor Grossman tells us, right, she's actually saying, you need to accuse Mordechai of treason. Show his disloyalty by not bowing down to you. That's an act of treason. But then, right, Hashem, who pulled all the strings, had Mordechai not only cleared of treason charges, but honored for finding other traitors, Bigtan and Teresh, right? They get hung, and therefore the tree that you made for Mordechai, ha-ha, will turn around for you. And then we end, right, really wishing that all of those Rishaim should find their end. So, Purim Sameach, Chodesh Tov, and in the big picture of the crazy Purim world that we're living in right now, we should hopefully all be able to see the Arurs and the Baruchs clearly.